Good afternoon, Tucson. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're live here for another great segment of American Warrior. You know, celebrate's not the right word, but we just recognized a pivotal battle in our American history, World War history, the invasion of Normandy, D-Day. There was another critical battle that took place, though, on the other side of the world. Some have called it the most significant battle in naval warfare, and it involved forces from the Japanese Navy as well as our military. Today we're joined by noted historian Robert Cressman. He's the historian at the Naval History and Heritage Command. He's written several books. Among them, he was the author of a book called A Glorious Page in Our History, The Battle of Midway. He's recognized nationwide as one of the preeminent experts on the World War II in the Pacific. He consulted on the movie Tora, Tora, Tora. He's appeared on the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, and Fox's War Stories with Oliver North. Robert Cressman joining us from the East Coast. Robert, welcome to American Warrior. Welcome back, I should say.
Hello, Ben. Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, how are things out there on the East Coast?
Well, typical Washington summer. Muggy. Thunderstorms pending. So we're just about what we normally have here.
Yeah, I tell you, out here in Tucson, we pray for those thunderstorms to come through. We're biting our lips waiting for the rain to come.
Yeah, I heard the weather forecast as I was on hold, and 104 degrees, 105 degrees. Wow.
That's nothing. That's nothing.
But there's no humidity, right?
Yeah, exactly. But it's a dry heat. That's our famous
dry heat, right?
Well, Robert, you are our, I like to claim you as our sort of our resident historian here on American Warrior Radio. When we debuted the program back in December, or redebuted it, you were our first guest, and It's just wonderful to have you back. I tell you, one of my favorite films of all time, World War II films, is The Battle of Midway. And I've often wondered how accurate that was, and reading some of your papers and preparing for today's show, I'm finding it was probably pretty close. So let's start off, if you would, sir, kind of set the stage for us about this pivotal battle. Where did we stand? This is relatively shortly after Pearl Harbor, the Doolittle Raid. Kind of let us know how the forces were lined up in the Pacific at that point in time.
Okay. Well, I think we have to go back to Pearl Harbor, where everything starts. The Japanese use of six carriers to hit one target is a bold step. Our Navy had only operated at most, two at a time. And when the blow falls on Oahu, we have three carriers in the Pacific, one's at Wake, or one's on the way back from Wake, one's on the way to Midway, and one's at San Diego, about to return to the Hawaiian theater. So right there, the Pearl Harbor strike force of the Japanese Navy outnumbers our fleet carrier forces in the Pacific 2-1. So we start off at that level. But I think what people fail to realize is that when the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor, they essentially hit the targets of a past war, which is the battleship. And the battleships that are sunk at Pearl don't have the speed to keep up with carriers in modern warfare. So Admiral Nimitz put it rather succinctly when he said it was providential that we lost those ships where we did, because if they'd been at sea or if they'd been off Lahaina, we would have lost them forever. But as it turns out, they're sunk in shallow water, and most, with the exception of the Arizona and the Oklahoma, return to service and perform fabulous service in the war. I mean, Nevada's both in the Aleutians as well as off Normandy, and the Tennessee and the California all go on to spectacular careers, you know, supporting invasions in the Pacific. So the Japanese start off with a tremendous strike, and they have a very wide-ranging war plan everywhere from the Far East, including the Philippines and Malaya and Dutch East Indies, all the way to Pearl Harbor. And so things pretty much go their way for the early months of the war. However, there are operations that are unfolding on the American side that often get overshadowed by the fact that the Japanese are so successful in so many places. Admiral Nimitz realizes that the principal weapon we have is the aircraft carrier, which having not been at Pearl Harbor, they have thus escaped destruction. And so a series of raids takes place. The The Marshalls and Gilberts are struck on the 1st of February, where you have Admiral Halsey having a task force around the Enterprise and Admiral Fletcher having one formed around the recently arrived Yorktown. And it's a successful strike in terms of damaging ships. The Enterprise's planes sink one ship and damage nine, as well as the first Japanese flag officer to die in combat is Admiral Yatsushiro Tsukuyoshi, who was a commander of the 6th Base Force, who was killed in his headquarters. Yorktown is less successful because they don't have many targets at their objective. So, but the strikes go off pretty much without any hitches. There's damage to the Enterprise and the cruiser Chester, but other than that, we have pretty much gotten away with a good first strike, operating two carriers against separate objectives. There's an attempted strike against Bougainville on the 20th of February, 42, which runs into difficulties because the Japanese have spotted them on the way in. But it turns out that the strike that the Japanese launch pretty much has have all their eggs in one basket in terms of their land-based air power, and it's absolutely demolished by the combat air patrol and by fighters operating in the combat air patrol and dive bombers operating as fighters. And that's a victory for our side. And then the strikes on Wake Island and Marcus Island by Admiral Halsey's forces go off without a hitch. The last of these strikes that is a tremendous success and is often overshadowed in discussions of this part of the war. So on the 10th of March, the forces of Vice Admiral Brown and Rear Admiral Fletcher fly over the Owen Stanley Mountains. Now, this has not been done before by U.S. Navy carrier aircraft. The carrier air groups of two carriers are brought to bear against one target, an invasion force off the ports of Leh and Salamaua in New Guinea, and they cause great damage, such to the point that President Roosevelt, in a message to Prime Minister Churchill, says, "This is the best day's work we've had."
Wow.
And he was correct. And that's the 10th of March. Now, the last strike that takes place here that really convinces the Japanese in terms of how they're expanding and what their timetable for conquest is a force consisting of the carriers Hornet and Enterprise gets to within range of Japan when they're sighted by what's essentially an early warning line of converted trawlers and fishing boats that are what's called guard boats or picket boats. And so they have to launch a little sooner than they'd anticipated. The plan had been to fly over Japan, do the bombing, end up in China where the planes would be turned over to the Chinese. Well, they have to launch further out so that the carriers aren't attacked in retaliation. The strike goes off as planned, but the planes crash all over this portion of China, and unfortunately none of them eventually are taken over by the Chinese. One goes to Russia, where she's interned at Vladivostok. But the raid convinces Admiral Yamamoto that the Japanese must deal with the American carriers, which is a thorn in their side at that point, such to the point that when the Japanese are planning to go down into New Guinea and in that area, the forces there require carrier air support. So that's why you have the Shokaku and the Zuikaku going down there, as well as the Shoho, which are assigned to the forces to attack Port Moresby.
Now, Robert, let me interrupt you. Just hold that thought. We're getting ready to come up on the first break. We had the great honor of interviewing Lieutenant Colonel Dick Cole, who was Colonel Doolittle's co-pilot on that raid several months ago. Just a tremendous story. Mm-hmm. Folks, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're joined by Robert Cressman, noted naval historian. We're talking about the Battle of Midway, June 4th, 1942. We're live in the studio. If you have a question for Robert, give us a call, 751-1041. We'll be right back.
those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking the Battle of Midway today. We're joined by Robert Cressman, who is a historian at the Naval History and Heritage Command, is on the horn with us from the East Coast. Robert, coming back to the show, we talked a little bit about what led up or just sort of the lay of the land leading up to the Battle of Midway. Now, Admiral Yamamoto, some would claim he was a brilliant strategist. I guess some others would claim he was just a goat. But one thing that he was right about was, if I'm not mistaken, part of his strategy with invading and capturing Midway Island was really his idea that Japan had to end this war quickly, because if the industrial might of the United States was allowed to build up, he just did not see Japan surviving that. Do you think that's an accurate statement, and that played a role in his decision or in the thought process on Midway?
I believe so, because one of his the quote attributed to him was, "I can run wild for the first 6 months. After that, I can basically assure nothing." He did know America, and he knew its incredible capacity. And I think there was a strong element that, you know, they needed to win quickly, or at least make the Americans tire of the conflict early on, so that they could get a negotiated settlement. Because I think he knew full well that in the end, Japan would not win.
Now, your first call to us, your first interview back in December, we were talking about Pearl Harbor and the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. Battle of Midway is almost the flip side of that coin. There was one message that was sent, and the message was, "Target is short of water." Tell us about that message and about Lieutenant Commander Joseph Rochefort.
Well, I'll tell you, the men who labored in the basement of the administration building at Pearl Harbor, in what they sometimes referred to as the dungeon, performed an incredible role. I would highly recommend a book that just came out fairly recently called Joe Rochefort's War by Elliot Carlson. It's a fantastic study of this man. The subtitle is "The Odyssey of the Codebreaker Who Outwitted Yamamoto at Midway." It's just absolutely fabulous. I don't think it'll ever be matched in terms of a portrait of Rochefort. One of the things was, at that point, the Americans, at least Rochefort's outfit, was convinced that Midway was the target of the next operation, to unfold the invasion. And so he didn't have to convince Nimitz, because Nimitz, I think, was leaning very strongly toward that as well. But the folks back in Washington needed to be convinced. There was a little bit of, Carlson points out in his book, there was some jealousy on the part of some of the people in Washington to what Rochefort was accomplishing. And so, to prove to Washington, not necessarily to Nimitz, the suggestion was made that Midway send a message in clear saying that it was having problems with the water distillation system.
In clear meaning it wasn't coded. It was just broadcast. Right.
Now, we had a secure cable connection to Midway, which was in existence well before the battle, that messages could be sent without having to go through the airwaves. And so we could tell the folks at Midway to send a message in clear saying, you know, this is, you know, we're having problems with our water distillation or water desalinization system. And hopefully the Japanese would go for the bait and pick up the message and rebroadcast it. And that's what happened. The message was sent. The instructions were said to send it in clear, which it was. And there was an in clear response back saying, you know, water barge is on its way. And so the people at Wake picked it up, which was, of course, in Japanese hands, and resent, saying, you know, AF is short of water. So it, AF being the geographical code that the Japanese had adopted for Midway. It was also picked up by the Australian decryption, the code breakers down in Australia, and rebroadcast as well, which confirmed to the folks in Washington that Midway was the next target.
So we knew they were coming.
We knew they were coming.
That always helps to know where the guy is going to throw his next punch. Now, just because you know they're coming does not necessarily mean you can always do something about it. So we had the Japanese carriers Kaga, Akagi, Hiryu, and Soryu lined up against the Enterprise and the Hornet. And another surprise character coming into play here was the USS Yorktown. The Japanese did not expect that. And explain to our listeners why that is the case.
Well, the Japanese thought that as a result of the Battle of the Coral Sea, that they had sunk not only the Lexington, but the Yorktown as well. And that buoyed their ideas that they could carry out their operation unhindered, figuring that the Americans only had two carriers left. Yorktown came back to Pearl Harbor and went into the repair basin at the Pearl Harbor Navy Yard, where experts looked her over and decided, what needed to be done. Nimitz purportedly said, we need this ship back in 3 days. So it wasn't an attempt to completely revitalize the ship, because that's impossible. You couldn't do that in 3 days. So what workers did come on board restored her seakeeping qualities, essentially made her seaworthy. She wasn't totally repaired, but there was enough repairs to enable her to get to sea and fight a battle. In fact, Nimitz noted that in the war diary. He said, her damages are not so as to prevent her from taking part in this next operation.
And this was done over the course of how long?
About 3 days.
I mean, that's still gargantuan.
It still is, yeah. Oh, yeah. They worked around the clock. So she was a very busy ship, because she'd been away a long time.
Now, the other, of course, it's always, you look back, it's always easier, 20/20 hindsight. But to me, one of the other critical factors was the Japanese had planned to send a whole group of submarines to arrive there to take part in the battle. And the U.S. forces got out of port early. And so, in essence, the Japanese submarines didn't get there in time. And that probably played a critical difference as well, don't you think?
Right. Also, another thing is that the Japanese, back in March, had supported a long-range flying boat strike on Oahu. The bombs had fallen on Mount Tantalus, nowhere near Pearl Harbor itself. But it convinced the Americans that something was going on, and so they looked into it. And it turns out that one of the codebreakers, Jasper Holmes, had once been a writer under the pen name of Alec Hudson. And Hudson had written a short story in the 30s about a submarine-supported flying boat strike. And so they looked into it, and it turns out, yes, the Japanese had been to, French frigate shoals, supporting a long-range flying boat. So, oddly enough, we end up with ships at French frigate shoals.
Huh.
And when the Japanese arrived, it's like, we can't carry out this operation as planned. So that whole operation didn't take place. They weren't able to launch that reconnaissance mission from a flying boat flying from French frigate shoals supported by subs. And the result is also the deployment of the Japanese submarines as a picket line across the expected line of advance didn't get into position until after the forces under Spruance, Task Force 16, and Fletcher, Task Force 17, had actually gotten past them. So that whole part of the operation just never took place.
Now, Robert, we've got about 3 minutes of the break, but one of the other things that I want you to discuss briefly, if you would, I think the other thing that the Japanese a mistake they made was not only misjudging the number and quality of our forces, but also misjudging the morale on the U.S. side. When you look at the leadership that was lined up on the U.S. side, it's like an all-star team. It's a dream team. It's Nimitz. It's Fletcher. It's Spruance. It's Halsey. I mean, these are names in history, but Spruance was sort of came in last minute off the bench, didn't he?
Yes, definitely. As a replacement for Admiral Halsey, who had come down with with shingles, and it was Halsey's express recommendation that Spruance be allowed to take command of the task force that Halsey had commanded from the beginning of the war. Now, Spruance had commanded the escorting cruisers since the start of the war, so he knew Halsey's operating procedures and essentially, had a good idea about how a carrier task force was run.
Now, was Spruance in charge of the task force that delivered the Doolittle Raiders as well?
And he was commanding the escorting cruisers at the time, so he had been along on that one too. So he'd been pretty much in everything, including the Wake Island reinforcement mission before the start of the war.
So So you've got those guys lined up on the U.S. side. Who are the all-stars on the Japanese side?
Well, the Japanese pretty much had the same team they had at the start of the war, if we, you know, continue that that analogy. Nagumo had commanded the Kido Butai, which was the fast carrier strike force, rampaging into the Indian Ocean, and was ready to take it against Midway.
Okay, and so we're, like I said, we're just about to take a break here. When we come back, I'd like to kind of get into the meat of the war, of the battle itself.
Okay.
Talk about some of the, you know, and again, in retrospect, a lot of, I don't want to say mistakes, but certain things happened that really turned the tide in our favor, both tactically as well as decisions by certain individuals. One of my favorite is Spruance's order, launch everything. You know, he really, for a non-flying admiral or Navy guy, if you will, he played just a critical role in this decision. What, the number of ships... Robert, how many did we combine? 100 ships, 150 ships on both sides?
Oh boy, I should have written these numbers down earlier. Let's suffice it to say the Japanese had a lot more at sea than we did. But that covers everything from the transports coming from the Marianas all the way up to the Aleutians. The American force, and I really didn't realize this until I read Shattered Sword by John Parshall and Tony Tully, that the actual forces engaged in terms of task force were about equal. The Japanese had four carriers, but we had three, plus we had Midway, which
right.
you couldn't sink.
Right, right. Hey, folks, if you want to chat with probably the preeminent naval historian regarding the war in Pacific, give us a call, 751-1041. We're live in the studio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking Battle of Midway. Stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back.
To reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American warrior.
We're back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by noted naval historian Robert Cressman. He's also the author of A Glorious Page in Our History, The Battle of Midway. And before we get back to our guest, I just want to remind you, if you have access to Davis Monthan Air Force Base, this Friday, June 13th, they're having a special wingman comedy show featuring comedian actor Damon Williams. It starts at 9 o'clock. $8 for ranks E1 through E4, $15 for E5 and up, and civilians. So if you're retired, go out to the Mirage, support the base, enjoy some great comedy. Robert, I hope you didn't misinterpret that I'm talking comedy while you're on the air.
No, not at all.
Now, just to be clear, if folks want to read your book, they can find that on Amazon or other places online?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. So we're back talking about probably what some people have described as one of the most significant naval engagements in the history of naval warfare. We talked about the lineups and going into this, you know, and just sort of watching the movie. And actually on YouTube, there's a little segment, a special that your office produced, I believe, about the Battle of Midway, which I encourage folks to go look at that. Just go to YouTube and look for A Glorious Page in Our History. It's a real good 12-minute segment outlining this battle. But the fog of war... That description probably was most appropriate when it came to this battle. I mean, it was a very complicated battle plan to begin with on the Japanese side, but the wheels started coming off pretty quick. And talk a little bit about scouting planes and how that, how basically the order of battle as it evolved at the Battle of Midway on June 4th.
Okay, the principal problems in with the scouting aircraft on the Japanese side was that they had such an obsession with secrecy that Admiral Nagumo did not have his float plane searches sent out until after the strike had already been launched on Midway. And they had some difficulties in launching the aircraft as well. So you come up with these little technical difficulties that sometimes intrude into warfare when things don't work, and you have to wait, you know, an agonizing period of time before you finally get the planes off. And another thing with Japanese reconnaissance was when the our forces were spotted, the report was very vague. It said, you know, 10 ships. Well, what kind of ships? Are there carriers? Are there cruisers?
Are they fishing boats?
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that that would have been foremost on the pilot's mind, you know. By the same token, our PBYs saying, you know, have sighted main body, which is not what they were looking for. They wanted the carrier. So on both sides, you have, you know, as I think I mentioned once before, as long as you've got human beings, you're going to have the fog of war. And that happened on both sides.
Now, you were describing my show prep, though, Robert, when you said that.
Right.
We're all friends.
Myself, I mean, if you could see where I'm sitting now, you know, I'm surrounded by piles of books and papers. You would.
You're a historian. That's forgivable.
There's a fog in the office. You know.
Now, once things really started picking up, and I alluded to it before the break, you know, Spruance was kind of came in off the bench there. As I recall, I read that to some extent he was not an aviator. He was,
no.
You know, there's some question about, well, do you put a guy who's not in charge, who doesn't know planes, in charge of aircraft carriers?
Mm-hmm.
But when the Japanese, at least the first body of the Japanese were discovered, he didn't hesitate. He judged that if he threw everything at the enemy, he would at least keep them busy and keep them off their backs. And his order directly was launch everything. I mean, everything could fly went in the air.
Well, the important thing to remember here, too, as well, is we had two task forces involved, and we had never really operated other than at Les Salomon, the Transmontane strike against the Japanese invasion force. We hadn't really done that very much, so we were very much learning as we went along. One of the men who definitely remembered what a previous lesson was Frank Jack Fletcher, because he had been in command at Coral Sea. And there had been a report citing, you know, Japanese carriers, so he had sent an all-out strike against the Japanese carriers, only to be informed when the pilot got back to the ship that had made the contact report, and I interviewed this man, and he said, yes, he sure caught hell for it, was that the way the code pad was organized, if it slipped down just a little bit, you could be reporting two carriers, but it would slip down and you'd become two cruisers.
Oh boy.
And vice versa. So Fletcher had launched this all-out strike against what turned out to be the Shoho, which was a small carrier, about in size to maybe a little larger than our Wasp and Ranger, which were the predecessor, the Ranger being the predecessor of the Yorktown and Enterprise and Hornet. And so he realized that, you know, you can't just send everything off at one time unless you know the full concentration of the enemy. And the Japanese had been reported as coming in, their carriers being in two groups. And so with one group spotted, he wisely held back and said, well, this might be just like at Coral Sea. So I'm going to keep the Yorktown air group separate. Keeping one squadron of dive bombers separate for searching, and then send out the strike of a fighter cover over the torpedo squadron and the dive bomber squadron. So that's why it wasn't a total all-out launch by our carriers at the start.
Yeah, Robert, how accurate do you believe the movie The Battle of Midway is?
Now, are we talking The Battle of Midway, the documentary, or the Hollywood version?
The other version.
The other one. Well, can we go on to another question?
I withdraw the question, Your Honor.
It has its point. I mean, but I'll tell you, War and Remembrance has a segment related to Midway, and I think that really captures the battle.
Okay.
From the perspective of a dive bomber pilot, and those were the guys that were literally the tip of the spear that day.
Well, and let's talk about Torpedo Squadron 8 and Ensign Gay. I think that's one of the more interesting stories of this battle. Tell us about Ensign Gay and his experience in this battle.
Well, the Torpedo Squadron 8 was the torpedo squadron assigned to the Hornet. They were, the Hornet being the last American carrier commissioned prior to World War II, being put in commission in October, and her air group being put together a little bit before that. The Hornet-based squadron was equipped with the Douglas TBD-1 Devastator, which entered service in the mid to late 30s, and at the time was regarded as a very modern torpedo aircraft, but by the time World War II was there, it really was not a first line. Well, it was a first line aircraft, but it had a successor coming off the plants in Bethpage, Long Island, the Grumman TBF-1 Avenger. That was a far better airplane. It was faster and carried better defensive armament. Carried the torpedo internally, not externally, where it would be a drag on the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And there was actually another component of Torpedo Squadron 8 that was equipped with the Avenger. So they had two different parts of the squadron engaged at Midway. Only six planes were able to fit on Midway, literally. And, I mean, Nimitz had written that Midway was given all the strengthening it could take. And it's, you know, on an island, you don't have a lot of spare room. So only six of the squadron's aircraft got out to Midway. The rest took off with the Hornet Air Group to strike the Japanese fleet. There have been many accounts of a disagreement en route between Waldron, who was the squadron commander, and Commander Stanhope Ring, who was Commander Hornet Air Group. And Waldron took his squadron off in a different direction than the rest of the Hornet Air Group, and thus attacked unsupported. He didn't know that at that time he was flying toward the squad, toward the Japanese fleet. He actually did have fighter cover, but they were from the Enterprise, and they'd gotten mixed up in terms of what squadron they were to follow. They were supposed to follow their own squadron, Torpedo 6, and there was a prearranged signal from the squadron commander to the skipper of Fighting 6, Lieutenant James Gray, and we'd say, "Come on down, Jim," and that was the signal to come down and help them out if they ran into zeros over the Japanese force. Well, the Enterprise fighters were flying over the Hornet torpedo squadron, and there was no signal. So they didn't know that they were being covered. So Waldron took his squadron in. They were the first torpedo squadron from the carriers to attack, and they were slaughtered by anti-aircraft fire and fighters.
And I think, so, just to emphasize that you're talking 30 men, and Ensign Gay was the only one to survive.
Yes, we're talking 15 aircraft, each with a crew of two. Normally, the Devastator carried a crew of three. The middle seat man was the bombardier, but of course, in a low-level torpedo mission, you didn't need the bombardier. So they were only flying with two-man crews. The same applied to the Enterprise as well as the Yorktown. So the squadron had 30 men engaged, and at the end of the battle, only one was alive, Ensign Gay, and his rear seat man, a fellow named Bob Huntington, had been killed. So he emerged as the only survivor of Torpedo 8.
Okay. Right, we're going to have to take another commercial break here. Got to pay for the show somehow, but we'll talk about Ensign Gay when we come back. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking Battle of Midway with Robert Cressman, noted naval historian. We'll be right back.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. If you want to support them, start with WoundedWarriorProject.org. Now, back to the American Warrior.
We're back, folks. We've got just one more segment left with noted historian Robert Cressman, probably one of the foremost experts on the World War II in the Pacific. We were talking about Ensign Gay, Robert, just before we signed off for commercial. He spent 30 hours in the water there, a front seat to the battle there, probably not the front seat he had planned on. Caller, John is calling, says Ensign Gay was his best friend. John, is this number one American Warrior fan, John Essinger?
This is him.
What? John?
Nice to meet you.
Same here, Robert. Hey, I appreciate all the good work you do. And did you ever have the opportunity to meet Ensign Gay?
No, I didn't. I saw him at a seminar, but he was like all the way across the room, and then I got swept away into something else, and I never did get back to talk to him. I've heard he was quite a character.
Well, he was, I met him, I was selected by the Smithsonian to be a special representative back to Texas in the early 80s, and he was a Texan. And I met him at an aerospace event, and one thing led to another, and we started talking on the phone, and I invited him to come to Amarillo, Texas, and be a guest speaker. Well, based on that, we became very close friends. And I got to tell you, there was no better patriot on the planet. And he had more humility than anybody I know. And you're right. He was truly a character.
Wow. That's great.
You know, maybe, John, you and Robert should sit down sometime and talk about that and record your memories.
Well, did you live in the Washington area, correct?
Yes.
Well, I'll talk to Ben, and I'm up. Matter of fact, I'm going to a board meeting up there soon. Maybe we can get together and tell some more stories.
Cool. Sounds good. I'd look forward to it.
And Robert, just to be safe, we can provide a translator for you.
Okay.
John, thanks for your call, and thank you for your support to our men and women of the military.
My pleasure. Happy contrails, guys.
Thank you, John.
Now, Robert. In looking at some of the online information, there were some segments about the Battle of Midway, and one of your compatriots referred to what he called the critical 4 minutes. And in essence, he said at 10:22 that morning, Japan was winning the war. By 10:26 that same morning, they had three aircraft carriers on fire, and a fourth would be lost the next day. I mean, that literally in 4 minutes, the whole war in the Pacific shifted.
Yes.
So what,
it's amazing how in modern war, and I would definitely call that modern war, things really did change very quickly.
So at the end of the day, what was, we talked about the lineups going into the battle. At the end of the day, what were the Japanese losses compared to our losses?
Well, by the end of the day, you had essentially four Japanese carriers were useless. I think two had already sunk at that point. America had one carrier damaged and two carriers intact. So the scoreboard was, when we continue that sports analogy, we were definitely winning the game. And you're right, it did happen really quickly. And there's a number of factors involved in this. And, of course, I realize we're running short of time here. But I think in terms of looking at how influences on our dive bombers, we got a submarine that found herself in the middle of the Japanese fleet, the Nautilus, which was the slowest and least maneuverable boat we had. And she popped up in the middle of the Japanese fleet and caused such consternation that Nagumo had to detach a destroyer, the Arashi, to try to keep her down or destroy her while they continued off on their course. So the Nautilus ended up causing a great deal of a diversion, so to the point that when the Arashi figured she'd sunk her or driven her off, she put on all the coal to rejoin the fleet. Well, Wade McCluskey, who was the Enterprise Air Group commander, was trying to find the Japanese fleet, and without a lot of success. And so he figures, okay, I'm going to fly this course, because he had to keep one eye on the fuel. And so he turned on this one course, and then he spotted this wake down below. So he put two and two together and figured she's going somewhere in a hurry. So latched onto her and followed her up there. Meanwhile, the torpedo attacks are occurring. The Hornet squadron goes in first, and then the Enterprise squadron. Then the Yorktown group shows up, and they're the only group to carry out a coordinated attack with fighters over torpedo planes and dive bombers. And so McCluskey gets his squadrons over the Japanese force and pushes over to the attack. But there's a last-minute mix-up where, in terms of the signal being made to attack according to doctrine, you know, who takes what ship. So it ends up that at the outset of the attack, and we're looking at one of these things where, you know, things aren't working out quite well, all the Enterprise dive bombers are going toward one carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And that is definitely an amount of overkill. Well, at the last minute, Dick Best, who's the commanding officer of Bombing 6, realizes this, pulls up his flaps, pulls out with two of his wingmen, goes to attack another carrier. So thus you've got two carriers attacked here. The Hiryu has somehow gotten herself separated from the other three. The Yorktown group, the squadron led by Max Leslie, part of whose planes are not carrying bombs because of malfunctioning electrical releases, including Leslie himself, they push over to attack on the Soryu. And so it's, you know, within those 4 minutes, you've got the Enterprise group going after two carriers and the Yorktown group going after the third. And by the end of the attack, those three carriers are out of action.
Wow.
Leaving the entire battle and whatever, you know, to try to redress the balance is in the hands of the Hiryu people.
Well, like in many battles, there's an element of luck involved, but there's also an element of leadership where McCluskey said, "Okay, here I see something. Let's because they were low on fuel, and he said, "Well, let's follow this guy and see where he leads us."
Yes. And then Best's decision to realize that everybody's going the wrong way, that his people are going the wrong way following McCluskey. And so he takes some, fortunately, two of his wingmen, remained on his wing and went with him to attack the second carrier in the immediate vicinity.
Now, so really the difference, the change here, the shift. I mean, I think it's not saying too much to say the Battle of Midway really changed the war in the Pacific.
Yes. We had realized prior to Midway that we could defeat the Japanese at their own game. You know, Coral Sea had been a victory. And so we were beginning to feel that we could do this. We were looking at tactics, really, you know, how to fighters and how to fight the Zero. And just, you know, how to make torpedo attacks, the dive bombing, and our training paying off. And after Midway, I'd say that we knew we could do it. You know, prior to Midway, we were pretty sure we could do it. But Midway was like, yes, we can do this. We can defeat the enemy at their own game. And we did it a couple times more before the year was over.
One of the things, Robert, I'm curious about, it's not just the loss of the equipment, the four carriers the Japanese lost, but they really, something they could not replace in time was really, they lost some of their most experienced pilots and crews as well in those battles.
Well, the biggest loss they had, and once again, I'm indebted to John Parshall and Tony Tully for this, was pointing out the number of aircraft mechanics who essentially never got off the ships. Into the hundreds, and they point out that an agrarian society such as Japan, who had only belatedly industrialized, you know, training a man from that kind of society to be good at maintaining a high-performance aircraft like the Zero, the D-3A-1, Ichi dive bomber, and the Nakajima torpedo planes, that takes some training, and that takes some acclimation to get a man from an agrarian society into an industrial role. And that was the big loss was in the trained mechanics and the guys that maintained the aircraft. The pilot losses were significant, but it wasn't until Guadalcanal when the Japanese started to feed their pilots into the Kona meat grinder. That's where the losses really began to mount up. On the contrary, our people would send our pilots back to the States, not only to give them a rest, but to inculcate the young guys coming up, the ensigns and the second lieutenants, into, you know, how to fight the enemy. And so a lot of the fellows that ended up at Pensacola and Jacksonville and Corpus Christi were veterans of Coral Sea and Midway.
Now we've got just a couple minutes left, Robert, but Admiral Yamamoto, when the news came in, when he got the news about the terrible loss at the Battle of Midway, what happened to him?
What I've read is that he was absolutely crushed, and he would not wouldn't eat for a little while. It really struck him hard, and in terms of how the Japanese greeted this news, it was like it never happened. I mean, the people who were casualties from the carriers that when they came back to Japan were almost treated like POWs. They were kept away from the public eye, and there was no acknowledgement that there'd been this disastrous defeat. And so, unfortunately, they were hit hard. And it surprised them. I don't think they expected to be hit as hard as they were.
Wow. Robert, thank you so much. Hey, folks, buy his book, A Glorious Page in Our History, The Battle of Midway. We'd love to. What's the next big event coming up, historical event we should be talking about, Robert?
Oh, boy. I would say Guadalcanal, probably.
Okay.
Coming up in August.
Well, can we get you back on?
Sure.
Okay, we'll make a reservation. Robert Cressman, thank you so much. Hey, folks, next week on American Warrior, the USS America. Sound familiar? Well, it's the fourth warship to be named after country, but she's brand new. She's the first of American-class amphibious assault ships designed to carry the Ospreys, the F-35. Next week, we'll be joined by Senior Chief Steve Kennedy, who will be phoning us live from the engineering compartment of the USS America, our latest brand new ship. Folks, hope you enjoyed it. You can tune in or visit 104.1 KQTH to get podcasts of previous broadcasts. Listen to our great guests. Thank you so much for being here. Thanks to Robert Cressman for calling in today. Have a great Sunday, folks.